Welcome to Black Hat Briefings, held November 21st through the 22nd, 2001, in Amsterdam. This is videotape number 3, Routing Protocol Attacks by FX.
Session. First, short introduction, what is this about? What can we do? We will look into different attack scenarios and see in general, high level, what can be done with protocol attacks. We go into layer 2 attacks using CDP, STP, VLANs. We will also cover some classics like ICMP abuse and ARP interception. We talk about discovery and attacks on routers. And we will finish the session with a little bit fun with tunnels and so-called private IP addresses according to RFC 1980. But first of all, the question is, why should you actually bother with this kind of attacks? You might think, it's strange. Nobody really uses it. So why is it affecting the reality of my network today? So to answer this question, I actually will read something CERT wrote in their latest paper about distributed denial of service attacks and the upcoming trends. And since it's pretty small here, I will read it to you. CERT says, of extreme concern is the potential of routers being used for DOS attacks based on the direct attacks against the routing protocols that interconnect the networks comprising the internet. We believe this to be an imminent and real threat with potentially high impact. So they're actually right and wrong at the same time, because it is a real threat, but why should you just use it for distributed denial of service attacks? So what threats are you actually facing? Well, in general, using traffic rerouting, an attacker might be able to sniff data streams he would normally not see. He could actually prevent data from getting from A to B. Data like, think of syslog messages, any kind of logging, accounting messages. He could even modify the data on the way. So back to the example of syslog messages, the message used to say login failed, and it will say login succeeded. Or he could actually impersonate a source or a destination of a communication stream, and hereby given a false sense of security. This is most commonly referred to as like fake service or fake logins, but it's actually very effective. Let's go a little bit into attack scenarios. This is a sample network, and this microphone sucks. On the left side, there is what you would call a normal office LAN with several PCs. They're connected to each other by a hub, which is then uplinked to a switch over here. Oh, by the way, I'm using the Cisco symbols here because I think most people are familiar with them, but this doesn't mean anything. These attacks can be applied to most devices that do routing. Yeah, back to this sample network. First, when a network was set up, the administrators decide to protect their server. I call it the server target. It's over here. By a router running some kind of firewalling software, packet filtering. Later on, yeah, we know how management is. Management requested, we want to have high availability for this connection. So they put in place another router over here using hot standby. And of course, nobody has time and nobody really cares about the routers. So it was just overlooked that the second router doesn't run any kind of filtering or firewalling software. Another router in this segment participates down here in what we call the inter-router network. And this network actually talks IGRP. And behind yet another router and yet another firewalling engine, there is a radio server to authenticate logins done on the routers. So we have this poor guy. Let's call him Attacker. He couldn't get a connection to the flat LAN. Of course, he would have preferred a connection to the flat LAN and just fire up his sniffer. But he was ready to put directly onto the switch. So after sniffing for some minutes and seeing lots of Windows broadcasts, he figures, this connection is directly to the switch, so I would go for protocol attacks. So what could he do? This one here shows a normal traffic path from workstation victim to server target. Packets are sent through the office LAN here, cross the switch, go through this firewalling router, and go to the server, same way back. So the first thing Attacker could do is a layer 2 interception. Most of you probably know it. We will discuss it in detail later. It actually gives him the ability to sniff all the traffic in this broadcast domain by routing all the traffic through his machine, which is pretty good for him. The second thing I call this local redirection is just Attacker modifies his own routing table or ARP cache. So his packets are actually sent through the backup router, who has its own IP and its own MAC address, instead of the firewalling router. And so Attacker can get to the server target without passing through any kind of filter software. But unfortunately, this doesn't work for the way back. So instead of using local redirection or ARP, especially these ARP interceptions, layer 2 interceptions are easily picked up by an IDS, Attacker decides he goes for directed interception because he just wants to see the traffic between victim and target and not between this other unnamed guy here. So what he does is an IRDP attack. He actually modifies the routing table of victim. So the traffic is again routed through his system instead of going directly to the router. Based on the attacks shown in the last slides, he decides that the answers coming from the server target shouldn't actually go through the firewall because, of course, he wants to do the full port scan, full exploitation thing. So he uses ICMP redirects to actually tell the server target here to go through this unprotected router instead of the protected router. And voila, no more firewall in between. Yeah. Most attackers don't actually work by procedures. So, yeah, he went on a little bit too fast and, yeah, went straight through ARP interception and all that. And while he tries to hack server target, he realizes, well, these two routers run HSRP. And as a good attacker, he knows HSRP is an easy target. So he actually now forces a switch over from this one to this router, using HSRP, and finally gets rid of the firewalling stuff permanently. Another normal traffic path. Attacker tries to log in to router backup using telnet sessions, which is, of course, not best practice, but he could also use SSH. And his standard connection is perfectly OK. But unfortunately, the router always goes down to this radio server here to authenticate the login. Now, while hacking into server target, the attacker found the configuration of this router. And of course, the first thing he did was breaking these very high secure Cisco password 7 encrypted passwords. But as we know, normal configuration guidelines say these passwords are only used if the radio server is not available. So what he does is actually this, the radio server not available. He uses an IGRP routing protocol attack to create a routing loop in this network here. And now he can tell it to router backup, who in turn realizes that he has no way to connect to the radio server, and his login is successful. We will discuss several protocols that use multicast in this session. And this slide is just here to illustrate how unpredictable multicast can be. This is nearly unbelievable, but I actually tried this myself. So this is a standard AIX installation, good IBM operating system, and has a checkpoint firewall 1 on top of it. We would assume that this is the multicast domain for one network, and here we have the multicast domain for the other network. This is not true. AIX actually forwards multicast packets without even asking the checkpoint software. So even if you have a firewall in between, you can't be really sure that you filtered multicast. This is how it is. Yeah? Yes. It's actually, if you want to test that, you go to NO-A, which is network options, and you see forward IP multicast is set to 1, and this actually causes the AIX software, the AIX IP stack, to forward the multicast without even telling the checkpoint software. Okay, so we saw the possible attack scenarios. How do they work in theory? I hope everyone is familiar with the ISO-OC modem. I assume so. Everyone not? Yeah, so good. So each layer has its own addressing, of course. The physical layer uses directly connected links. I think most of you actually followed some cables in some computer rooms to find out which layer 1 addressing this switch used. Layer 2 uses data link addresses such as Ethernet MAX or whatever layer 2 protocol you use. Layer 3 uses the well-known IP addressing and routing. Layer 4 traffic is actually divided in IP by ports and protocols. The IP stack decides using the protocol and the port, which service is talking to which service. And this all leads to an application stream. By modifying one of these addressing mechanisms, you can modify the flow of information in the network. And that's the whole idea of protocol attacks. It would be great to just get a, yeah, thank you. Okay, for layer 2, it looks like this. You conduct a man-in-the-middle attack. You give false data link addresses to server and client, server over here, client over here. They normally talk to each other. They find out which address the other one uses. And, yeah, you give them false information, both of them, and you will forward the traffic. This mostly requires access to the broadcast domain, of course, because layer 2 attacks mostly require access to the same layer 2 area. But the biggest advantage, of course, is you don't touch the layer 3 protocol. That means IP and the whole ISO-OC stuff here was designed so the layers are independent from each other. And as long as you work on layer 2 for the attacks, most mechanisms to spot you that run on layer 3 will not spot you. So for layer 3 attack, it works basically the same way. You give false next hop information to one or both parties, which looks like this. The advantage here, of course, is you can do things remotely. It doesn't require you to be on the same layer 2 segment. And as the attack scenarios showed you, there are plenty ways to do it. So let's go into the protocols. The first one, Cisco Discovery Protocol, is one of these that run on most networks and nobody really cares. The intention by designing this network was to make troubleshooting simpler for Cisco operators. So have some value-added feature to Cisco devices. The protocol runs directly on data link layer and provides information about device connected, the medium, whatever. So other Ciscos can actually see this packet and have this in an iOS displayed. So if you look for CDP neighbors, it will tell you, here we have these Ciscos connected to the cable. But the protocol informs an attacker who listens on your cable about IP addresses, software version, platform capabilities, native VLAN, and so on, which can be used for attacks. So this is how it looks like when you actually, as an attacker, scan for a CDP. It has the device ID, port ID, platform, what capability, duplex, the software ID, which is very handy if you have some kind of Cisco exploit at hand, and some more. Switches also do that. So this is a switch giving away his information. I actually wonder where CAT DEFCON 1 was located. Doesn't matter. And on top of this, CDP is vulnerable to a memory exhaustion attack that might negatively influence the capability of your Cisco device. Means you're locked out. So this happens if you actually flood a Cisco with random CDP messages. It has no more memory, so it is unable to accept routing protocol updates, telnet sessions. Anything that requires a little bit of memory is just no longer possible. To protect yourself from this to happen and to hide your valuable information from the attacker, because CDP has no real productive use to you, just go to your Cisco config and say no CDP run. This is highly recommended. Spanning tree, or STP, is used to calculate forward paths on flat earth networks. Means switch networks, anything that's not using routing. For the situation on the left side here, it's pretty obvious that the switches have to figure out some kind of distribution path. Of course, because if I have a station over here that's sending out a broadcast, what would happen without the path calculation? The broadcast would go through the first switch over here to the second switch over here. Both would receive the broadcast from the other switch, would forward it again, and you have a real nice broadcast storm and your network goes down. So to prevent this, so-called BPDUs, bridge protocol data units, are sent out by the switches, and they actually agree on a switch route, which then leads to a logical forwarding tree that I tried to illustrate on the right side. So S2 is forwarding everything to S1, who's the root switch, and S1 decides the distribution, which prevents loops. So of course, there are possible attacks. For larger networks, sending out a lot of more or less correct BPDUs, an attacker can force the switches into an continuous recalculation of the path, and hereby making the network real unstable. And most of you who actually work with networking equipment and had to debug spanning tree issues in the past know how difficult it is to find that out. So he could actually send these. And if he managed to send the right information to the switches, and he managed to gather enough information about the network, he might actually become the switch route with his station here, and is suddenly in a very strong position because every Ethernet frame is first forwarded to him. And it's perfectly transparent. Okay, talking about VLANs, IEEE 802.1Q VLANs are very often used as a security solution. Well, when looking at the VLANs in general, it's not a great idea to use them as a security solution, especially not if you use any kind of VLAN trunking. This is well known, but I think it's interesting to see how it works. When you have VLANs across multiple switches, you have one switch here and one here, you have to interconnect them somehow. So we have the green VLAN here, that's VLAN 1, and we have the blue, that's VLAN 2. And to get the information from VLAN 1 here to the VLAN 1 here, it has to go through a router, through what's called a trunk, this thick line. The frames actually get tagged with a little mark. This is the following VLAN information, and are sent into the trunk. And on the other side, the tags get stripped off from the switch, and the frame is sent to the right port. The tagging actually looks like this. After the well-known destination and source, you have this little tag protocol identifier, which looks a bit different for each and every layer 2 protocol. This is Ethernet 2, actually. It just identifies what's in there, what's coming after the 4 bytes tagging here. And then you have the tag control information here that has the user priority, the canonical format identifier, and the VLAN ID. Oh, well. And then the normal stuff you know from Ethernet frames like type and payload follows. So, if an attacker does the so-called VLAN hopping, he actually exploits the fact that some switches accept tagged frames on non-trunk ports. What does it mean? The switch receives a frame that's already tagged, that's already prepared for transported over the trunk, on a port that's not part of the trunk. Basically, the port is not connected to the router. And some switches accept this frame and forward it. This is the case in a default installation on Cisco. If you're coming from VLAN 1, you're actually allowed to send trunk frames. So that's what we try to illustrate here. The attacker sends an already tagged frame to the switch. Here's the tagged frame. The frame, of course, has to be addressed to victim's MAC address already, because we're talking layer 2, and mechanisms as ARP don't work here. And if everything works well, the frame is forwarded unmodified through the trunk, and on the other side gets stripped off and gets delivered to victim. Of course, this is a one-way game. Or you just install some kind of real strange Trojan on victim to get the traffic back. But then you probably don't need VLAN hopping. Okay, here comes a classic. Address resolution protocol. Most of you know that, so I go through this pretty fast. Host A wants to talk to host B somehow. Figures that this is 10.1.1.2. On the data link layer, he finds out that what is the MAC address of this host. So he doesn't know. ARP kicks in. He sends out a broadcast shouting through the world network, hey, who is that? What's your address? Host B answers with the MAC address, and host A can now communicate. This is well known, isn't it? Okay. So the interception, ARP interception or ARP attacks, work basically the way that the attacker knows that he will actually hear the cry for help from host A. Since host A is doing a broadcast through the world broadcast domain, he would see this packet even on a switch. So we have the same procedure here, but attacker could be more chatty or faster or just stress the point that he's really host A or host B or whatever he wants to be. So everyone will believe him. Looks like this. Here's the question. Here comes the legal answer. Attacker appears. Ooh. Another answer. Attacker answers with his own MAC address. And well, while at it, he can actually lie to both parties. And so they both believe that the other side is actually attacker. And now everyone is addressing Ethernet frames to attacker. This is a classic layer 2 ARP interception. It's very powerful because there is no real way for good protection. The only protection that you can do is configure MAC addresses on switches hard-coded per port, which is a high administrative effort. And so this works pretty good. It even works on wireless networks. ARP interception, same way. You have victim-victim talking to each other. You run your ARP interception. That's it. Since access points on wireless networks are mostly hubs or switch-like devices. It's pretty obvious, but of course, if you want to, you can write a white paper on it. ARP attack risks. So as a result, which risks come into play when someone is doing ARP attacks on you? He could sniff, of course. He could modify the data stream. Why? Because the attacker has to forward the packets. He's actually forwarding packets. So he doesn't have any time constraints there. He can forward the packets and have some kind of processing in between, which modifies the packets automatically. It's not a race condition because he gets the packets directly addressed to him. He can block the traffic, of course. Like if you do an ARP interception and you have IP chains running on your little Linux box or IP tables, you can actually say, everything that looks like IPsec is going down the pan. So that's it. So no IPsec is going to happen. You can do this with like SSL encrypted connections. So you force users that actually have to talk to the server to use plain text so you can actually sniff. Or you just do rerouting because it's forwarded to you. You decide the next hop of forwarding. So you can actually use yet another router that uses a completely different routing path and send the packets through the network. Even your trusty DHCP protocol can be used for that. This slide is actually not in there, so this is one of the cases where you have to download the updated slides. Sorry. Okay, so what can we do with DHCP? First, the attacker takes out the real DHCP server simply by requesting all available IP addresses. There are tools to do that, and it's pretty fast. IP addresses are a limited resource, and if you request all of them, the DHCP server is no longer able to answer any kind of request. So now, when the client asks for an IP, attacker is the only one who can answer. So here, host A requests DHCP config. Attacker supplies IP and configuration, which of course includes default gateway and DNS. And of course, attacker is not going to supply the real default gateway and the real DNS because, yeah, that would be waste of time. He uses his machine's IP address as default gateway and as DNS, which makes host A, let's say, highly dependent on attacker's host. And that's how it looks like. Yeah, let's speak about routers. How do we find them in the first place? Because before we attack them, we should actually know where they are. There are passive and active ways to detect routers. Passive ways includes find all kinds of multicast, broadcast traffic that's connected to routing protocols, or we listen to IRDP advertisements, or we just wait for any kind of CDP showing up, so we actually see the routers when they talk on the network. This actually gives us a lot of information, but for the real fun, we go for active scanning. We can scan for autonomous systems, that's the separation between routing protocol instances. We can scan for them. We can send out router solicitations in IRDP to find routers, because they will answer if they're configured to do so. We can use the normal OS fingerprinting stuff, so when it says, it's a Cisco, then it's probably a router. We can do protocol scans and port scans for different routing protocol ports and protocols that have to be available. Or we just go into the next best management system that looks like HPOV or whatever and request, frankly, a list of available routers, which mostly gives us the SNMP communities as well. So discovering routers looks like this. You have the first four lines are passive discovered. It's IRDP from the same host announcing two different default gateways. Enhanced IGRP, two different autonomous systems. And what's neat, it gives you the iOS version and the enhanced IGRP version. So again, if you have any kind of special exploit for the 11.1, here we go. The rest is actively discovered by, in this case, by ASS, just joining the enhanced IGRP group membership and asking friendly for the routing information. And everything you get, you see you have a lot of information you can use. It's like the destination networks, if it is internal or external. For external links, it actually gives you the source of this link, like this is connected, this is coming from yet another enhanced IGRP router. And yeah, you have everything you need to perform your attack. So which tools do we have to discover these? That would be the ASS we actually showed in two slides here already. The Ether protocol analyzer is real good, and if you prefer to do your stuff by hand, go for this one. You can use NTOP to find central points of communication in the network that actually lead you in the second place to routers. TCP dumps-e gives you data link addresses, and if the destination data link address does not match the destination IP address, this one is addressed to a next hop, which is probably a router. Or you just use Nmap to scan for IP protocols or ports. You can ask the next DHCP server if he would be so nice and supply a default router to you. Or, as already mentioned, you take over a network management system and it gives you all the available routers in 32-bit high color. ICMP router discovery protocol, IRDP. We actually mentioned it here twice already. It's used to have hosts relieved from the task of configuring the default gateway. You know, the average Windows user has probably no idea what a default gateway is, so it's just left blank. The router advertises himself as a router, and the machine can actually access other networks. So routers advertise themselves, host broadcast for routers, which is called a solicitation. Fixed routes, if you have a default route configured on your host, has normally a higher priority, means a lower matrix, but the routes that you get via IRDP come right next to your hard-coded default gateway. So the attack is very obvious. make yourself known as router. Kill the default router temporarily. Sometimes you don't even have to do that. And then route the traffic, which looks like this. You just disable this router here, and everything goes through you. If you are in a network where the router is actually a dial-on-demand router, or anything else that takes more than, let's say, 2 seconds to get the line up, this line here, then you're happy because you don't need to take out the router. Windows is very funny because it does IRDP all the time. So you're sitting here doing IRDP advertisements saying, hey, I'm a router, but Windows already had configured this router here as default gateway. You just wait till this line here is not online. Let's say it's an ISDN PPP connection. You just wait until this connection hit the idle timer and went down. Then, if this host is trying to connect to the internet, he is sending a packet over here, of course, forwarding this packet to the router. The router figures, oops, line is down, have to get it up, starts dialing, and yeah, this takes 2 seconds. But in this time, this host here decides, oh, I saw another router that said he can do the job, and he will actually forward the packet to you. And all you have to do is make host A happy, like send anything back. If it was a SYN request, send back any kind of reset or whatever. So he has the feeling he's actually communicating. That's fine. And as soon as this line is online, you can really forward the traffic, and you got the route without even touching this thing here. So this technique can be used directed or wide, like in broadcasts, because you can send your IRDP advertisements directly to one host, or as they are designed, to the world broadcast domain. Windows systems are actually the best targets, because first they don't like any kind of delay in the communication, so as soon as a delay happens, they take the next best router, and they do IRDP all the time. Means even if the system is up and running for, let's say, 2 days, which would be kind of funny for Windows anyway, then you can actually force the system to use your router by having the special preference field set to 1,000, because they do a very funny thing. And I don't know why, but what they do is they take 1,000 and subtract the preference sent in your IRDP packet from it. And this actually gives them the metric. Well, so if you set it to 1,000, you actually have a metric of 0, and you are the default router. Windows 2000 and Linux, on the other hand, are not even listening to this kind of ICMP. So this is kind of limited. ICMP redirects, well known to most of you probably, are very handy, and actually more powerful than mostly assumed. They were introduced to make routing more effective. So this is the normal way. Host A sends his traffic to router R1 because it is configured this way. And router R1 figures, I'm forwarding this frame again to the same segment, to another router with the IP address in the same segment. This doesn't make sense. So what he actually does is he tells host A, see, that doesn't make sense. Please use router 2 for the next communication. And of course, this works vice versa. So if we want to attack something, you just make yourself the default gateway for this specific destination. You just tell host A, sorry, your routing wasn't that effective. Could you, like, next time forward your packets to me? And he will do that. Very important. Two things. First, Most systems require that the ICMP redirect packet carries 64-bit minimum of the offending packet, which makes actually sense because they want to know which destination address actually caused this message. So they know which communication actually has to go through the new router, which is you, next time they want to speak to it. The second thing is, this being ICMP running over IP makes it usable remote. If you carefully craft your ICMP redirect packets, you can actually force vowel traffic path links like routes over multiple routers to do what you want. So the most simple example for that is if you make the host B over here talk to you. This is the absolute simple way because you get the first packet from host B to you. You construct an ICMP redirect packet based on this information and send it back. And if he uses like multiple routers over here, you can influence which router he uses. Of course, you always influence for the host you send the ICMP redirect to. You just influence his next hop. So if you have multiple routers in between, like four hops, you have to do four ICMP redirects to actually influence road traffic path through routed networks. Host reactions, how does it look like? Windows loves ICMP, really. They're happily inserted into the routing table as a host route. So this is, on the other hand, good for the defender because if someone is playing ICMP redirect tricks on you, you just do a route print and you see all the host routes appearing in your routing table. For Linux, it pretty much depends on the distribution what the default setting is. So check your proc file system. Since the redirect things, even if they are accepted, are not showing up in your routing table, you have to check the proc file system to see them. And of course, if you want to test this in your lab network, you can use URI's ICMP redirect tool or just the one that's in the ERPAS suite. And this is how it looks like for Windows. We had some redirects here. Windows system was talking to these hosts. ICMP redirect was sent with this as a default gateway. And yeah, that's how it looks like. So if you have something like this on your Windows box and you didn't configure them yourself, you should actually start a sniffer and find out what's going on. Routing protocol. The first one, Interior Gateway Routing Protocol, IGRP, is a Cisco idea. It has 65,535, means 2 to the power of 16, possible autonomous systems, which can, of course, be discovered. What you do is what I call autonomous system scanning. It's basically the same as protocol scanning or port scanning. The only difference is you iterate through all the possible autonomous systems and see who's answering. So you can actually discover them because the number of autonomous systems is the same as the number of TCP or UDP ports in IP, and you all know a port scan doesn't take like days. It's pretty fast. So this is discoverable. It uses no authentication. Thank you. Various data on link is used for calculating the metric, which means you have the delay, bandwidth, reliability, load, hop count, Cisco sunshine phase, whatever, and it's all calculated together to come up with some kind of strange metric. And of course, if you provide this data here in some kind of packet you send to the router, you can obviously produce the better link because you're not bound to real-world constraints. A host can listen to IGRP without saying anything. This is, most know that, called a passive interface. So you should use protocol scans to find out if this host is actually capable of listening to this protocol. And by making up updates, and crafting your delay bandwidth and reliability and load while used correctly, you can introduce routes. Keep in mind, though, that your network, the source network you claim to come from, we all know this doesn't have to be the network you're actually connected to, has to be enabled as possible source for routing updates. This is the network statement in your Cisco config. So we will use IGRP to discuss the general application of routing protocol attacks with made-up updates. We can use IGRP to introduce new routes. Sounds funny, but what do we gain from doing this? Our attacker has a simple goal. He wants the password that host B over here is sending to this nice little server over here. Let's say it is an POP, login, FTP, whatever. So, but being over here, way on the other side of the routed network, there is no way to sniff the password, and well. So what are we doing? First step, he adds a second IP address to his host, which is actually, as you can see, the same IP address as server has. Then he tells router 1 that he actually uses for this update router 3's IP address as the spoofed source. He tells router 1 that 10.103.2, his real interface address, is absolutely the best way to reach this 10.1.1.2. Now he tells router 2, using R1's IP address, that R1 is absolutely the better way to reach 10.1.1.2. And now, if host B logs in and tries to access 10.1.1.2, he's actually forwarded from this to the better next hop, R1, from R1 to the better next hop attacker, and this one is running the fake server, and so he logs into attacker's machine. And of course, attacker gets the password. If for some reason attacker just wants to prevent communication between the two, he can make up routing loops. He tells R3 that R1 is the best way to reach host B, and he tells R1 that R3 is the best way to reach host B, and then he enjoys seeing the packet using up its TTL. Routing Information Protocol, RIP. It's probably one of the oldest still in use routing protocols. It uses fixed network sizes in the version 1. RIP has no autonomous systems and just runs on top of UDP on port 520, so you just go for port scans to find it. RIP v1 heavily depends on broadcasts, which makes it easy to set up but also easy to spot. There is, as you see, a RIP version 2 that can actually cope with variable-sized subnets, and it even supports clear text authentication by the RFC. Or if you just have Cisco equipment, you can use the non-standard, not compatible MD5 authentication. But basically, the attacks are the same. You can introduce routes if you know the right authentication, assumed someone is using RIP v2. Of course, you have to watch out for the network boundaries in RIP v1. There is a thing that's called split horizon with poison reverse algorithm that is designed to prevent routing loops in RIP networks, which actually works the way if a router gets a routing update, he sends back the same routing update to the source of the update with a modified matrix that's infinite, which is the number 16 in RIP. So you have to watch out for this one. If you want to do a routing loop, use three routers or whatever. And of course, there are tools to send these things out. Enhanced Interior Gateway Protocol, or Enhanced IGRP, is probably one of the most used Cisco protocols because it's very easy to set up, and it's said to be pretty effective. It has 2 to the power of 32 possible autonomous systems, but the iOS shell only suggests the first 65,535, and I've actually never seen someone using a higher number for autonomous systems, and I'm not even sure if it is going to work. But the protocol defines a 32-bit field for autonomous system. It still has no authentication and still uses a lot of different information to calculate some kind of strange metric. The only difference is, to talk to enhanced IGRP routers, you have to join as a neighbor. You have to be a neighbor so you can talk to them, much like some closed-up neighborhoods in the US. As always, your source network has to be enabled as a possible source for route updates or a possible place for a neighbor to be. So if the Cisco config doesn't say network XYZA and you're not in there, sorry, this is not going to work. So introducing a route here is, as I said, the same procedure. The only difference, first, you temporarily join as a neighbor, which is not difficult, and then you introduce your, let's call it special routing information. OSPF, open shortest path first, is a pretty complex interior gateway protocol. And I go over this and the BGP slide pretty fast because Nico and Sebastian are going to cover this more extensively. So it basically sends out link state advertisements in Halo packets to a multicast address. These OSPF networks are split up in areas, and you can like spend half a year to design a big OSPF network. So OSPF has a lot more security features than the other protocols we just discussed, but since OSPF is so tricky, most designs are flawed, and you can exploit that. So just to demonstrate the fact that OSPF is complex, we just took a complex attack. Instead of just sending OSPF information around, which experiments have shown mostly leads to completely denial of service and no intelligent attack, we just go for a combined layer 2, layer 3 attack. You have the router 1 here and router 2 here, and they're all talking together, OSPF. And attacker just does first the layer 2 ARP interception, very basic thing between the two. Oh, we had a very funny discussion because OSPF runs mostly over multicast. It was doubted that this is going to work. It's going to work because the multicast is used for the LSAs, and if you have a communication to transfer routing databases, it's directed, and it's, again, using ARP, so you can do this. And when the database transfer goes there, attacker gets it, modifies it, sends it back into router 2, and he will distribute the false information. You should take care that you do this before the routing information becomes public knowledge in the network, because every router in an OSPF area knows the status of the complete routing table. So if you try to send in a fake route that's already known in a routing table, the specific one, then the routers will start challenge this forged LSA, and you will have a hard time to convince all routers in this area that your routing information is the correct one. BGP4, Border Gateway Protocol, is an exterior gateway protocol. It's mentioned here only because it's kind of important, and the audience probably knows why. BGP relies on TCP for communication. There is an interior BGP and an exterior BGP. The interior one really needs some kind of interior gateway protocol to reach the neighbors so they can communicate via TCP and sort of possible attack scenarios include somehow sending bad updates. You can intercept TCP connection between two neighbors, or you just attack the interior gateway protocol that gives interior BGP the information how to reach the next neighbor. All these attacks are not really fully researched, or to be more precise, these research results are not published. So this is kind of, yeah, let's call it not public knowledge, more like underground knowledge about how to hack BGP 4 nets. But yeah, as a reference, the next speech will be more in deep here. We go back to funny things, HSRPE, hot standby router protocol, yet another Cisco idea. Multiple routers share a virtual IP address and a virtual MAC address. There is a default one, but you can change that, and it doesn't help you. The router that's active and is actually holding this virtual IP address and is forwarding the traffic, and all the others sit there and wait that the first router dies, much like management. You sit there and wait that your boss is either kicked out or leaves the company. So the protocol talks over UDP multicast and uses clear text, 8-character authentication. Well, you obviously can wait for the multicast to come through your machine and read this clear text authentication, but most people don't even bother to set the password. The default password, by the way, is Cisco. When an active router dies, the standby routers fight for the active state, and whoever has the highest priority wins. You see, not much security in here. The successor of HSRP, called VRRP, is actually another RFC 2338, provides you with a little bit more authentication because you can use the IPsec authentication headers. Anyway, we go for the classic HSRP. This is how it looks like. You have router 1, router 2, they're talking HSRP. The blue thing here is this virtual IP address, so everyone is using router 1 to communicate to the, let's call it, internet. If you tell router 1 that router 2 is actually way better machine and is brand new, and router 1 should really use router 2 as the active one, that works. So router 2 gets the virtual IP address, and everyone talks via router 2. Of course, you can tell both, hey, I'm the super Cisco device, and you should give me your virtual IP address. And it works like a champ. You get the virtual IP address. Everyone is communicating over your host, and it's perfectly transparent to all clients. Thank you. Cisco's recommendation by now is to use IPsec for the communication, HSRP. But as very trusty sources told me, this is not really working, or at least if you have more than two devices, it's kind of tricky. So, yeah. watch out before you configure HSRP. And you would be surprised to see how much, let's call them e-commerce companies, run two HSRP routers in front of their firewall to have high availability to the internet, and didn't even bother to change the password from Cisco to something more creative like secure. After so much routing and, yeah, lots of paper, we jump into tunnels. To make it perfectly clear, we're not talking about IPsec tunnels here. If I could break into IPsec tunnels, I would probably not talk to you, but have fun in your internet right now. So, and we're talking about unencrypted tunnels, which can be abused since they're basically just encapsulation. So the idea is to generate traffic as a normal participant of the VPN would do, encapsulate it, send it to the tunnel destination router with the spoofed source address in an outer packet of the defined tunnel source router, and so get the packet into this VPN. The return path highly depends on the scenario. Vulnerable protocols include IP encapsulation, IPv4 and IPv4, generic routing encapsulation, and anything else you might see that uses outer packet, inner packet send. So we go for an example, generic routing encapsulation, most used. It's a trunnel protocol that basically is designed to transport protocol A over protocol B in a backpack. That's it. It's pretty simple in the definition. The RFC is like a fast read. You could transport IPv4 in V4, V6 in V4, IPX in V4, so on, whatever you want to combine. The best authentication it can give you is a 32-bit fixed tunnel key. So, yeah, I mean, you have to send out like 4 billion packets, and this might take some time, but there's still a chance to brute force a 32-bit tunnel key. Anyway, mostly this tunnel key isn't used because you have to configure it, and yeah, you know, configuring keys, no. It also supports sequence numbering to prevent tunnel attacks, as the one I'm going to show you on the next slide. But these sequence numbers are so weak and so badly implemented, you can just plain ignore them. First of all, they don't use any kind of cool sequencing as TCP is supposed to do, but they just start by one and count upward. But if you just send packets without these sequence numbers, the other tunnel router will assume, oh, this one hasn't sequence numbers configured, so yeah, so I don't use them. So you can really ignore this feature. And even more interesting is the fact that GRE can carry source routing information. So on top of getting your packets into the tunnel, you can actually tell him how to route them after he decapsulated them. Once upon a time, this is a very common situation, at least in Europe. Whoever is interested, I can tell you the companies and products that actually sell this here. The situation is, we have a company. On the right side is the headquarter. On the left side is one of their branch offices, and they want to communicate. To be really independent from these registration authority things, they went for RFC 1918 IP addresses and configured the world network with a 10 thing here. So, and now they want to save money. They had lots of leased lines across Europe, and now they decide, no, this is not good. So we asked our carrier for a solution. And of course, the sales droid of the carrier has a solution. He calls it a VPN to tunnel the traffic between their internet routers. They set up a network as follows. The default gateway in the branch office is this router, who in turn sends everything he gets on his interfaces into the tunnel, so it gets out here on the headquarter router. The router on the headquarter just tunnels all the traffic that's designated to one of the branch offices because he's also responsible for internet connectivity of the HQ. Now, client 10.1.5.2 over here can actually talk to this nice little server. So, making the game more interesting, to add security. Security is important, they figured, so they configured security features. The branch office router drops everything that's not GRE and not coming from the HQ router. Okay. All outgoing traffic is forwarded into the tunnel. Nothing is gonna leave the outside WAN interface of the branch office router that's not GRE. The HQ router blocks all incoming connections, on the WAN interface, except for GRE. So they're pretty secure. Well, this is the situation, and we have our poor attacker. He has his own network, and yeah, after inspecting the situation, it looks like he has no chance to attack one of these computers, because not routable IP addresses, there's no way to get in there. He can't even address the packets because it would be dropped at the first ISP here. Like, who do you think you are that you address 10 networks in the internet? So, is he lost? No, he's not. He sets up another router. We call this an attack router because the purpose is actually to do evil routing. In this case, this is some experimental software we wrote. It should be on your CD, but you can actually do this with a well-misconfigured Cisco as well. So then he actually makes this attack router the default gateway for his traffic, and he generates traffic that's directed to 10.1.5.2, his target system over here. So this is the packet, very simplistic IP frame. This router here encapsulates the packet and does IP spoofing, of course, using HQ's source address, branch office's destination address, GRE header, and then the original packet. Sent over here, so the access lists are passed because all the requirements are fulfilled. The router will decapsulate it here. And according to his routing table, finds that 10.1.5.2 is reachable over the Ethernet interface and forward it to this host. Which means, actually, that attacker reached the host. Now, we say the back path depends on a scenario. In this scenario, attacker is real lucky. Because this host answers. Default gateway is this device. Default route is put it into the tunnel. So it goes into the tunnel, goes out here, gets decapsulated. This router, since he is responsible for internet connectivity, knows how to reach this IP address because he has an uplink IP address for the ISP, sends it out, and voila. Finally, attacker is talking to a non-routable IP address, which was supposedly protected by a GRE tunnel and access lists on Cisco routers over the internet. Voila, no more protection. The same procedure can be used to attack IPv6 hosts connected over IPv4 internet. Whoever experiments with V6 islands knows that the connection is actually done by GRE open to the next best V6 6-bone connectivity. So if you have a 6 island, you connect by GRE. Of course, the way to the V6 host is you generate the V6 packet, encapsulate it in V4, and send it to the host. The way back, obviously, doesn't work that well, because as soon as the V6 answer packet comes in here, he figures this is not going to work. So this is a quick summary of the tools. You, as far as I know, have them on the CD. Check back for updates. And yeah, you can download all the stuff from this URL. You have it on the slides. Summary. Come on, be nice. Thank you. So, we saw there are many ways to alter a traffic path. This is not a complete list. So, your fantasy goes on and on and on. Everything that uses any kind of addressing or gives any kind of information dynamically from host A to whatever host B can be misused. Most routing protocols are insufficient protected, which makes the routing protocol attacks very successful. And unencrypted tunneling represent a high risk. They're still in very widespread use, at least in Germany. And they demonstrate the fact that so-called private IP addresses are not a tool for protection. They're just a tool to be independent from registration. That's it. So this is the final slide. Thanks to these people, thanks to Nico and Sebastian for assistance, and of course to you people here and not falling asleep. Okay, minus one. And listening to me here and being here at Black Hat. And whoever wants to earn such a shirt I'm wearing, it has some code on the back. And if you're interested in getting one and you have fun with like simple reverse engineering over two or three beers, go to www.darklab.org and yeah, figure out what the code does and send us an email and you will get a shirt. Thank you.